This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zackheim, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
On this episode of Reaganism, Reagan Institute policy director Rachel Hoff sits down with Niloufar Ayoubi, who is an Afghan activist, journalist, and entrepreneur who escaped Afghanistan shortly after the Taliban takeover in August 2021. They discuss the situation for women in Afghanistan today, Niloufar's individual story, and the prospects for the future of Afghanistan.
Well, hello and welcome to Reaganism. I'm your guest host, Rachel Hoff, and our guest today is Niloufar Ayoubi, a businesswoman, an entrepreneur, and an advocate for women's rights from Afghanistan, who was forced to flee after the Taliban takeover in 2021. Niloufar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
You know, when I think about President Reagan's legacy in today's world, I'm so inspired by people like you who are really on the leading edge of the struggle for freedom and for human rights around the world. And I thought we'd start our conversation, Niloufar, just by defining a key term for our audience. So you speak and have been so involved in the fight for women's rights in Afghanistan. And I thought it might be useful for our audience just to tell us what you mean by that. Of course, the term women's rights has such a particular meaning in every context in which it's used. And we use that term in America and in Europe, where you are now in the West. But in unfree societies, it tends to mean something quite different than the context of the free world. So when you speak about women's rights in the context of Afghanistan, what do you mean?
Well, it's pretty simple. When you go to Afghanistan, what we mean by women's rights is to be simply, exist, to be seen as human beings, not just merely objects or vessels of production and then the objects to be kept in a corner of a home or just servants. We just want to be treated as we are born, like as a woman. I am born as a woman and I would like to live as a woman. But at the same time, I was born as a human, which in my country, in the male patriarchal societies, they tend to forget that as a woman, I am much more capable and powerful than they can think. I am the woman who is the creator. I am the woman who bore these children for the 9 months in my stomach. And even the men are born from me. But instead, they just see me as, you know, a mere object, a tool of, you know, just throwing here and there like a toy you give into a children's hand. I do not have a right to my name. I do not have a right to my child's. My name is nowhere to be seen in my child's birth certificate. I am born nameless. I am raised nameless, and I die nameless. There is no name in my tombstone. So that's what human rights means for us.
You mentioned what it is to be a woman in Afghanistan, particularly under the Taliban rule, and that you were born a woman, but you experienced something quite different in your childhood, even during the time of Taliban rule, than other young women, young girls at the time. Tell us a little bit about the way that you grew up.
Well, I grew up as a bacha posh. Bacha posh is a term for women in Afghanistan who have to sacrifice their womanhood and dress as a boy, pretend to be a boy, and also be careful not to be caught, just in order to provide for their families. Because during the course of 40 years of war, many family doesn't have a male in the family to provide, a male provider. And under the Taliban's law, in the Sharia law, a teeny tiny boy, even as young as 3-4 years, have more respect than a grown woman or an older woman. So you have to have that boy if you want to step outside your home, if you want to go just for the grocery shopping. But in my case, it was a little bit different. I did have my older brother. But just to experience life, just to not miss on those little bit, you know, humanity that men under Taliban experienced, my father decided that I will be dressing as a boy so I do not miss out on anything.
And what did that allow you to do that other girls your age were not able to do?
Well, I was able to play outside. I was able to go to the market. I was able to accompany my father to the places where it was impossible for my sisters to even imagine to be in. I remember that I would go with my father to Buzkashi game, which is a national game in Afghanistan, a national sport, where hundreds and thousands of men come to watch it, but women will be nowhere to see. So I enjoyed those little freedoms, which seems very little, but that makes quite a lot of difference. And most importantly, I was not forced to sit at home, learn the womanly course, you know, to sew, to wash, to clean, you know, to become a servant. That allowed me not to be a servant, but instead also gave me this power of, you know, being a man. And then I was the man when my mother would go to a market, and I would be leading my mother when I was like such a young child. So, yeah, it's now that I think it was quite sad, but I enjoyed that freedom. I enjoyed leading my mother, me, a small child, you know, dictating my mother, okay, if you don't buy me this, I'm going to leave you alone and run back so the Taliban hit you. The morality police catches, you know, this small naughtiness in the children. But now when I go back and think, I feel so bad for my mother that she bore me and then I was the one leading him just because I was dressed as a boy.
It sounds like every child's dream in some ways to be able to control a parent, but it's so much deeper than that, as you describe, mm-hmm. and the situation that put your mother and so many other women in Afghanistan in. When you became older, of course, it was impossible to hide the fact that you are a woman, and you went on to live as a young woman in Afghanistan and really spoke out in favor of women's rights, of human rights, in the context of a really conservative and obviously, especially under the Taliban, a very controlled, oppressive society. Can you tell us a bit about sort of, you know, I'm sure you understood the risks that you faced when you were speaking out, what happens to women who speak out in societies like this. Where did you find the courage to continue to speak out and to begin your activism?
Well, to be honest, I know I come from a patriarchal society, male-dominant society, but for me, everything came from my father. My father was such a great part of my life that if I am who I am today, it's because of him. He was a very educated man. He was an educator himself, despite coming from a background of how should I say it? He did not need money to survive, so he could have just sit in his luxurious life and enjoy, but he decided that he would become an educator and live as an ordinary man. That's what he taught us, that be as ordinary as possible, but at the same time, do not give up on your rights. And be it if you're a girl or if you're a boy, it doesn't matter. You're equally as human beings. And that's where I got my courage, because whenever I would create a chaos in school, I would pray that they would call my father, not my mother. Because when it was my father, it would go quite in my favor. But when it was my mother, of course, mothers are more concerned about the daughter's future. So I would be grounded for sure. But at the end of the day, I think both of them did a great job raising all of us, our siblings. And it was not easy, not for them and not for me. I have been name called. I have been labeled at a young age of as young as 13, just because I wasn't the typical woman in the society, just because I was questioning and challenging some of the narratives and taboos in the society, just because I would ask too many questions from my teachers in school, that why this is this and this is that, why women are not equal, especially when it was our religious lessons every day in school, I would ask questions that normally it would be called blasphemy in such societies. But because my father was a well-known educator, so they would not put me into this, you know, field court, but they would warn my father from time to time that your daughter is going to get all your family killed. So it was not easy, but I'm happy that my father stood firm and strong behind me.
How old were you when the Taliban was overthrown after U.S. and allied intervention in Afghanistan?
Well, I was quite young. I think I'm born in 1996, just when Taliban took over. So I think I was 5 years old when they were overthrown. But Taliban was overthrown in 2000. The society, however, the Taliban mentality, it took years for us to change that. And we were not even halfway there when everything was snatched from us, unfortunately.
Not even halfway there, but those 20 years between before 2021 must have been so different for you, for your family, for your mother, for your father and your friends. What was that time like, relatively speaking? More freedom, more opportunity? How even if things changed slowly, what started to change?
Well, to be honest, it was like for the first time, these black and white TVs turned into color. It was exactly the same situation for us. Life, even the air we smelled, brought more hope for us, more, you know, good news. There was hope that, okay, first good news was school. That I could go to school. Girls were allowed to go to school. There were nobody to stop girls from walking on the street. Of course, we would be covered, but at least our faces were showing. And year by year, this, you know, the spring was getting closer and closer and closer, and so much opportunity, so much potential, so many young girls' life changed for better, so many women's life changed for better, so many, I think hundreds of women got graduated from schools, thousands of graduated from universities, so many jobs for women, and we were growing quite fast. I don't know if we had this feeling that we have a very short time, so we got to try everything, but everybody was in a rush. So fast forward to 2021, half of, I would say 60% of the market, at least in Kabul, was taken over by women in the business. Women were in the media, women in business, women in the health services, women in the security forces, women in the government. So also we had relatively overcome the situation that women were slowly taking the lead. I know that it was tough for the men, but, you know, men, we were in a situation that in social media, no man would dare to say anything misogynistic, anything, you know, against women. And everybody would try to be well-behaved, you know, respect women's rights. But as I said, it didn't last long.
When the government of Afghanistan collapsed in 2021, you know, the eyes of America, the eyes of the world were on the situation unfolding, particularly in Kabul, particularly at the airport. You, of course, had a front row seat to that chaos, being somebody who had spoken up during those times when the Taliban was not in control, and had built such a career for yourself and as a businesswoman and an entrepreneur. What were those days like for you in 2021 as the government started to fall?
Well, I think Among prior, we felt the chaos when the provinces were falling back to back. But to be honest, personally, I was so naive that I had never thought that we would be back to the Stone Age. I was so confident of the development of the investment that had been made in Afghanistan that none of us thought that we would be left like that. Because we don't know, nobody comes, you know, in your country, spends so much, invests so much, and not only that, you know, sacrifices so many soldiers in this war, and then it would be impossible, you know, to let those sacrifices go in vain. And that was part of, you know, assurance for us that, okay, maybe there will be a little bit of clashes. We have the strongest army. It will be fine. We will survive. And everybody was calling, my friends, my family kept asking, leave Afghanistan, like a month or two prior. I said, well, where am I going to go? This is my home. And I started giving interviews, and my interviews are there, that if Taliban wants to come, now I feel sad, and also I feel ashamed because I didn't stood on my words, that if they want to come, they have to accept me as who I am, and I will continue working. And at that time, I really did not think that, okay, I chose this path, but my children has nothing to do with this situation, and I'm putting them in danger, and for what? And we didn't know that we were going to face such a betrayal. But unfortunately, it happened. Even the morning of August 15, we were continuing the normal life. We went, my staff was at work. I went to ID office. We had our breakfast. Girls were in school. When I left home and saw that little girls in uniform coming out of school, like, it was a normal day. And when it happened, it's like, I'm still in shock. It's been 2 years and few months. I still think that everything was just a nightmare. And I don't know how I got the strength. I don't know how I gathered myself to survive that very moment and what happened after and what's been happening so far. It's catastrophic for me.
Well, the images, you know, are stuck with us who were only watching on TV, and I can only imagine how much more traumatic it was for you and so many others who were living it as your day to day during that time. And you were able to flee Afghanistan. So many did. Others were not able to. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like for you? How you were able to leave, and maybe even some of those moments from the days that I'm sure that future wasn't exactly clear once even you had the idea that you did need to leave.
Well, I did try to stay as long as I can. I just went into hiding so to see the situation, what's going to happen. And then they started going to my office, to my showroom, to my warehouses, because everywhere is, you know, equipped with the security cameras, and I could see it in my mobile. That's when I started to panic because it was tough. I had to take my children to safety, and I thought, okay, let's do something. Let's get these children to safety, and then maybe I would be able to go back and continue the fight. Because at the same time, I was leading this group of women protesters, and we were planning protests on the streets of Kabul. By then, I wasn't into any evacuation list because I had never affiliation with any international NGOs, foreign entity. I was a self-made entrepreneur and a journalist. But during my interviews, one of the journalists from Poland said, are you into any list? I said, no. And I refused to go to airport just without any confirmation because I have three kids and they were little. The youngest was 11 months old. So it was impossible to just go there and then anything could have happened. This journalist put me into the list and said, just, I received the message around 1 a.m. and said, just 2 backpacks, your children in at the airport, be at the Abbey Gate. It's not easy. You work 20 plus years for a life, which you built from bricks, and then they ask you to fold it in just 2 backpacks and your children and leave. And at that time, and it's whenever I talk about it, I get emotional, is that I didn't know what to do. I didn't know. I was like, I wanted to get to safety because of my children as soon as possible. But at the same time, in my heart, I said, I wish I don't make it. Because at the end, I would be able to tell my children I tried, but I couldn't. So I stayed back in the country if anything happens. It was a long 3 days of hassle to reach. You know, I always watched these apocalyptic movies from Hollywood. I thought, no, there's no such thing. Even if the world is going to end, people, human beings are not so cruel to one another. They do not climb each other, you know? They do not just step on each other to reach to a safety. But when I reached to the airport, I saw that with my own eyes. I saw women being, you know, run over and women dying because women, of course, it's not only running away. You have to cover yourself with these black things and face cover. And it's August. It's 40 degree heat. And then once you're stuck in the middle of these humans of, I think, 100,000 plus people were there. Then there's no back, no forward. If you get suffocated, you die. And I saw people dying. My poor children, they were feeling, you know, one after other, they would feel unconscious. And then we had to pour water on them and then wake them up. It's such a vivid memory that I have there that, to be honest, my coping mechanism is that I try to forget bad things. But this one I can't. This is impossible. And if that wasn't bad enough, we were recognized by Taliban. And one of them just pulled my husband and put gun on his head that they wanted to kill him, shoot him down, because he was head of one of the biggest media groups, private media sectors in Afghanistan, Movie Group, for a long time. So he was also on the hit list. He was also very much wanted. And then I started begging and crying, please, we are living our house, our life, earned money, everything for you, our country for you. Just let us go. I have 3 children. Please don't do this. And then my kids screaming, my son and daughter, that please don't kill my mother, don't kill my father. And then they hit me very hard with the back of this gun, AK-47, I think. They broke my nose and they started shooting like 1 inch above our heads. And I remember my kids screaming and I thought I'm dead. For a moment I blank out, I didn't know what happened. And then apparently some other Talib guy pulled this one and said, and pushed it, said, let's go. Let's go, this is not the time. Just let them die. Let them go. And when I opened my eyes, I was looking if my children are hurt, if my husband is hurt, if I'm hurt. And luckily, we weren't hurt. But my children, I think for months, they would scream in their sleep. They would be sleeping and suddenly start screaming and running around the house. That's the trauma that it left. It took my children therapy, a lot of months of therapy for them to forget that thing. But for me, because I couldn't, it was only me and my family. I left my mother and family behind. So To be honest, every single night, I'm still at the airport. I'm still trying to cross that hell, and somehow I don't make it. Because deep down, after I left, my family has been tortured immensely, and this is the first time I'm talking on media about it, because I had to keep on a brave face. My mother was tortured so much that her collarbone was broken. My elder brother was tortured and dragged. My younger brother, I can only share this much, that it's my family is suffering back in Afghanistan, but it is what it is. I cannot. My father taught me that never to stay silent in the face of injustice. So here I am.
Well, as much trauma as you had to endure to leave, you know, hearing about the trauma of those who stayed is so impactful and poignant as well. What's life like in Afghanistan today for those who didn't leave or couldn't leave?
For the women, I don't think there's any life left. It's horrible, you know. If you haven't experienced this freedom before, it's easier for you to survive. But once you have seen it, you have tasted it, and then being pushed back inside homes, it's like each one of these women feel that they're in solitary confinement, that nobody is there to listen to them. They're so much, they feel so much lonely that, you know, they're trying to convince themselves that, yeah, this is life as a woman that I have to accept. But at the same time, there are many, many women who are committing suicide. With the lack of independent media on the ground and not proper reporting, many things goes by unreported and unnoticed. Life is, I don't know how to explain, but it's like when you put you know, it's like putting a human being alive inside a casket and letting them suffocate and die slowly. It's like being in this casket that you cannot break free. You're scratching, you're screaming, you're, you know, panicking, and there's no one, absolutely no one who cares or who can help you. This is how women feel. And with the women that I am in contact, I have my young cousins who are deprived of education now in Afghanistan. Some of them have been chased by Taliban for a forced marriage. So they had to flee from one city to another city. And this is how women have to, you know, families have to hide their young girls. So any Talib commander doesn't find out that there is a young, beautiful girl, because they will snatch it from them. And not just in a respectful manner, just third, fourth, five, six, seven wife. Just like tools, just like, you know, the eras of the, I don't know, 700 BCs, where kings would have these harem of women just to play with them. This is how life has turned for me.
Hearing the story of what life is like in Afghanistan today, the pain and suffering and oppression that so many are living under, especially during a time when, you know, the eyes of the international community, the eyes of the world are drawn elsewhere largely, right? So much focus on the suffering in Ukraine and in the Middle East. And it seems like Afghanistan isn't in the headlines like it was immediately after the withdrawal and the fall of the government. And what would you say to leaders in countries in the world about what more they could be doing to help the people that you've described who are there living under those conditions?
Well, I would just like to say that by closing your eyes and shutting your ears, will this situation isn't going to be resolved and it's resolved and it's not going to go away. What I'm going to say that here we talked about more about the women's rights aspect, but when you go look at this in a larger scale in the international security level, this is like a cancer and this is like a coronavirus, which is spreading quite fast and very, you know, it's taking over. And if not for the sake of these women, but for the sake of your own country's safety, just open your eyes, open your ears, and take action now before it's too late.
So much of what other countries are trying to do, you know, whether it's trying to pressure the Taliban to change its behavior to respect human rights, but so much of the focus is also on alleviating the suffering of the people, the regular people in Afghanistan, and those two things are hard to do together, and they're sometimes in tension with the Taliban currently as the government. How should we think about balancing those two things? How to help the people of Afghanistan, but at the same time encourage the Taliban to change? Or how should we think about that?
Well, I know it's a little bit too late to have leverage on Taliban by the international community, because when they could have the leverage and when we were shouting and screaming that please listen to us and don't do this, they did not listen to us. It's like, how are you going to have leverage on a group to whom you are sending 40 million a week in cash? And how are you going to make them listen to you when after each of your conferences, which is held, you know, to resolve this issue, they issue 5 more decrees on restricting the women, on depriving the women of their right. And then yet again, you go back to them and sit with them and send them money. I understand that it's my people who are suffering, and of course I would not want them to suffer. I know that we have to keep the humanitarian aspects separate from the other issues. But here in my country, it's very interconnected. You cannot separate the human rights from women's rights. It's the same issue. And if you're even the humanitarians, you're sending this money, but the country is falling rapidly below the poverty line. There are kids, I mean, millions of people on the verge of starvation. Then where is this money going on? It's not that Taliban, apart from what's Taliban, you know, receiving from the international community, what's happening on the ground, that Taliban are charging 3 times more the taxes from the common people, a person who cannot, you know, earn a one-day bread for the family. There are taxes imposed on the citizen that they're just extorting this money. Where is all this money going? Of course, it's going to the terrorism. How are you supporting a group which has launched 10,000 madrasas? You know what? We had few of these madrasas in Pakistan, and the result is Taliban in Afghanistan. They took over an entire country, and the result is Al-Qaeda. And we know that the what's happening in Middle East is the same situation. From these madrasas, extremism, this is where all it happens.
So imagine in these, are those religious schools, right, where that,
yes,
that training.
Yes, any religious school where they try to, you know, orchestrate the children's mind is dangerous. Any religion, I'm with due respect to all religions, I do practice Islam, but I do not practice it the way these terrorists do. I want to believe that my religion is the religion of the peace, but these goons wants to say that our religion is to kill, our religion is to wage war, our religion is to kill anybody who does not believe what we believe. So imagine 10,000 children, and there is money for these madrasas, but when it comes to girls' school, when it comes to schools, actual education system, they say we do not have enough fundings. Teachers have been, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs. These teachers were earning from these jobs. They say, we do not have enough teachers. How do you have enough people for the madrasas and not for the education system? So I think the world needs to take a closer look on this. If you do not want a repeat of October 7, if you do not want a repeat of 9/11, if you do not want extremism to come, you know, just knocking on your door, do not ignore the situation in Afghanistan. It is not only a women's rights catastrophe, it is a human rights catastrophe. It is, you just gave a country of 40 million population for this extremist, for this terrorist to grow. It has become, you know, Afghanistan has gained the title of Bora Bora for the terrorists now. Daesh is there, Jaish is there, Lashkar-e-Tayyiba is there, Haqqani is there, the Chechen extremists are there, the Chinese are there, the Russians are there. So imagine, this is my country which is being, you know, torn apart, and this is my people who are paying the price of, you know, this wrong policies from the world. And this is a very dangerous situation, and it needs an immediate attention.
Well, you make a powerful case for why Afghanistan matters, why it matters to the people there, of course, and why it matters to the world. You also spoke to something you touched on earlier in the podcast, that women's rights are human rights. And of course, the attacks that we've seen on women's rights recently are certainly not limited to Afghanistan. You've spoken out also about the assault on women's rights in Iran in recent years.
Yes.
What do you see as kind of the linkages between not only the oppression of women in these societies, but what are the similarities across those that are fighting for women's rights across these societies against oppressive regimes?
Well, it's very simple. It's political, religion, or I would say political Islam. It's not the real Islam that we are talking about. They're politicizing the religion in order to, you know, the dictators are using religion as a tool to oppress their people and then to rule on them. What's happening in Iran is, somewhat, Iran is a little bit advanced country than Afghanistan. They had more chance of education, growth, you know, their culture is still alive. They have beautiful country, beautiful cultures, but what we are seeing there is horrible, horrible situation, that women are being, you know, targeted, attacked, blinded, killed, and executed for just, you know, a piece of cloth on their hair. When I talk of women's right and human's right, I support the woman who wants to wear a hijab by her own will, and I support the woman who doesn't want to wear this piece of cloth. It's their choice. When I say women's right, it's the right of woman on her own life, on her own decision, on her own body. In Afghanistan, in the past 20 years, hijab wasn't compulsory. But because of the society, women were used to it, so they would wear it. But in Kabul, you would see women not wearing hijab, driving, going to the studio, watching football. But in Iran, it's not the case. Women are not allowed in the stadiums. They're forced to wear this piece of cloth. As long as you have this piece of clothes, it's fine. But women of Iran has come to this understanding that this is not a piece of cloth. This is the way that they want to control women, because they could not control their education, they could not control their growth, and now they want to control them with this piece of cloth. So I think it's very common. It's not only in Iran. The moment I arrived in Poland, we had a similar case with the abortion here, that a young woman died because she was refused abortion, even though her baby had died in her womb. And since then, there are movements going on that if women are in need and their lives are threatened, they should have these choices. You know, women are struggling across globe. What I learned in this past 2.5 years, It's just that it's on different levels. In my country, we are just, all we want is, you know, to breathe, to exist, to live. And when I come to the Europe, and when I come to the US, I see that, no, it's, women are struggling. I still see on higher levels these, you know, this imbalance situations. I'm learning a lot, and I don't want to speak on the topics without proper knowledge, but I see that women are not completely free, and they do not have their rights 100% anywhere in the world, unfortunately.
Well, we've spoken today about so many very difficult but very important topics, and I want to end on a note of optimism, hopefully. Could you articulate, what's your hope for the future of Afghanistan?
Well, I just hope that my people, my sisters in Afghanistan, and of course in Iran as well, because it's very close to my heart, we survive and we come out victorious from this gender apartheid which is being imposed on women in Iran and Afghanistan. And I certainly hope that one day all of us could go back in our country, walk on our streets, and be free of all these religious extremists and have a free and fair life in our own countries.
Well, we always end our Reaganism podcast with a lightning round where we ask our guests to share their favorite President Reagan quote or speech or a book. Do you have anything to share, Niloufar, with our audience today?
Well, as freedom is very close to my heart, so I would share this quote from President Reagan, where he says that freedom is never more than one generation extension. If we didn't pass it to our children through our bloodstream, which I think is very, very important in this time for all of us, especially for us women in Afghanistan, that we pass this freedom through our bloodstream to the next generation and preach freedom and exercise it.
Certainly something that you and your family and the people of Afghanistan know all too well, the power of freedom and the idea that you can't take it for granted. Niloufar Ayoubi, thank you so much for being with us on Reaganism today.
Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Reaganism. New episodes premiere weekly every Monday on YouTube and all podcast streaming platforms. If you like this episode, be sure to let us know and share with a friend.